This is an Alexandrian Media original podcast.
American writer Kurt Vonnegut once said, "If I should ever die, God forbid, let this be my epitaph." The only proof he needed for the existence of God was music. Music and spirituality have been siblings since the dawn of our civilized world. Our ancient ancestors labeled music as a divine gift when they attributed it to a certain deity. For the ancient Egyptians, it was Ihi, Apollo for the ancient Greeks and Romans. In the Norse pantheon, it was Bragi, and for the Mayans, it was Ashokshin. Nearly every ancient civilization had a deity or set of deities who were the patron gods of music. But somewhere along the way, the gift of music from the gods to humans was returned back to the gods in reverence and praise. Specifically with the ancient Greek society, music wasn't just a form of entertainment. Music was a way of life. Together with gymnastics, yes, that sport that requires a great deal of training and strength and balance, music was one of the main divisions in one's schooling. If you didn't know music, your connection with the gods were not as strong as those who did, and in turn, your spirit was incomplete. Music had power. Music was power, and that power would cycle back to the gods eventually. This had been a way of life for thousands of years, and when Christianity and all other Abrahamic traditions were introduced into much of the world's culture, music remained a constant. Music was always, and will always be, a gift from God, a channel through which we are able to communicate with our Creator. The music itself, too, has changed. There never was one single way to perform music, and there never will be. With so many instruments, genres, tonal systems, practices, and an indeterminate amount of other variables. However, music is still music, and each individual person expresses themselves and channels that spirituality in their own unique way. That's what makes the music of Anton Bruckner so special. Every piece of music, regardless of what genre it belongs in, was just another way for him to connect with God on a level that only he could fully understand. Yet, audiences of his music, to this day, are still able to listen to the music and feel that reverence that Bruckner poured into every single note. And while, yes, Bruckner wrote music that can easily be performed in a church service, he brought his faith to the concert stage, producing symphonies and other concert works so magnificent they rivaled the operas of Wagner and the tone poems of Strauss. His faith never faltered, staying strong until the day he died, leaving masterpieces unfinished. One of those masterpieces was his Symphony No. 9, a symphony that was to be so majestic that it needed no explanation as to who it was dedicated to. This is the Composer Chronicles, a podcast that recounts the stories of composers past and present through the music they write. I'm Stephen Trigar, and this is episode number 40, To the Beloved God. Very little about Bruckner's life is discernible from his musical works. Listening to one of his symphonies or choral works would most likely paint a picture of a wealthy man who had no qualms when flaunting around his money and fame when walking around the streets of Europe's greatest cities. However, the exact opposite is true. Scholars of Bruckner's music often find it odd that a man who wrote music so majestic was so simple and provincial of a man. However, one thing is certain. His music didn't hide his pious nature. Until he was 60 years old, Bruckner had never experienced broad fame and acceptance of his music. He sat too far from either of the two pillars of music at the time. On one side sat Richard Wagner, and on the other sat Johannes Brahms, one constantly looking towards the future, and the other clutching onto the past. Yet, here stood Bruckner, admiring both great composers and emulating both within his music. It was the premiere of Bruckner's Symphony No. 7 that brought Bruckner to the fame that he knew in his final years. In a field where talent is discovered and cultivated from an incredibly young age, Bruckner was an outlier. His musical studies continued into his 40s, studying with composers decades younger than he was. All of his great, numbered symphonies never started until he was in his 40s, completing his first mature work in 1864. Now, in 1887, with 8 numbered symphonies and several unnumbered symphonies under his belt, as well as a plethora of large choral works, Bruckner began work on what would be his 9th and final symphony. First draft sketches were completed in August of 1887, and the first score of the first movement began in September. He had just finished the first version of his Symphony No. 8 in C minor, and sent them to the conductor Hermann Levi, who was a close friend of Bruckner and was to look over the symphony. Levi did not find the 8th symphony favorably, and he wrote back to Bruckner that the orchestration was impossible to compile and the themes of the work were unmusical. With notes from Levi in his hand about the 8th symphony, work on the 9th symphony stopped, but revisions to the 8th were not the only revisions that he made. At the same time, he also took on revising his Symphony No. 3. He worked on revisions of the two simultaneously for quite some time. Other projects also got in the way. In February of 1889, Bruckner desired to have his Symphony No. 2 published, a work he completed and premiered nearly 17 years earlier. He was indeed successful in getting the work published, but he wouldn't get around to that until after the revision to the 8th Symphony was completed and started up similar revisions to his Symphony No. 1 and 4, together with his F minor Mass. Ironically, Wagner's influence on Bruckner seemed to go deeper than just music. Wagner's scatterbrained approach to completing projects seeped into Bruckner's as well, as far as composing, but I'll get back to Bruckner's affiliation with Wagner a little bit later. It didn't take nearly as long for Bruckner to get back on track to writing his final work as Wagner did, but Bruckner was certainly less willing to share that he had already started it 4 years before making a 9th symphony public. But then he went back to composing other things instead, finishing his setting of the 150th Psalm and the male choral work Helgoland. Finally, in 1893, 6 years after he started, the first movement of Symphony No. 9 was completed. A few months later, the second movement followed suit, and then nearly a year after the first movement came the third movement. This is the moment where the completion of the symphony comes to a grinding halt. Revisions to other works and his deteriorating health got in the way of completing the fourth movement, and eventually he would pass away before returning to that work. But he wouldn't die before leaving some potential pieces to fill in as the fourth movement. Several composers attempted to finish the symphony using the surviving manuscripts for the finale, but it seems that Bruckner knew he was going to die soon because he would leave behind a suggestion to use his Te Deum, composed 10 years prior. Bruckner was adamant that the symphony not end with the Adagio third movement, and if he couldn't complete the symphony, then the Te Deum would be that resolution. The only major problem, the Te Deum and the rest of the symphony are in two different keys. Much like all of Bruckner's symphonies, there are discrepancies between the manuscript and revisions, as many people tried their hand at completing the work, and after he died, some of the pages were lost. While there are many performances and recordings of this work being done, none of them are what the composer had intended, and we may never know. We are certain, however, that this work was dedicated to God himself. In a biography of Bruckner by August Goderich and Max Auer, they recount a conversation that happened between Bruckner and his doctor, with Bruckner saying, quote, "I have already dedicated two Earthly Majesty symphonies to poor King Ludwig as the royal patron of the arts, and now I dedicate my last work to the Majesty of all Majesties, the beloved God, and hope that he will give me so much time to complete the same," end quote. And indeed, this piece is majestic. Its key of D minor feels like merely an illusion, consistently breaking itself from earthly shackles to stretch towards the heavens and shedding light upon all those who listen to its brilliance. However, there is a dark side to this whole story, a story I have refrained from telling until now, and we'll get back to that dark tale after the break. What would a world without music be like? I certainly don't want to know. This podcast would not exist. Luckily, we don't have to find out what that world is like. I do a lot of listening in a day between all of my favorite music and podcasts, and it's not just for entertainment. I'm constantly doing research for this podcast and switching back and forth between apps to listen to a podcast episode and then a piece of music can get tiresome if I'm trying to quickly switch back and forth. From an episode of Hey Riddle Riddle to Stravinsky's The Firebird Ballet Suite and then to Lady Gaga's latest album, I can listen to them all on Amazon Music whenever and wherever I want. I start listening when I get into my car, and then when I get home, I switch over to my Alexa while I cook dinner for me and my fiance. Listeners of this podcast can join me in listening to all of the best music and greatest podcasts on Amazon Music Unlimited right now when you sign up today at getamazonmusic.com/thecomposerchronicles and get your first 30 days for free. You can get unlimited access to any song and do all of that listening without any ads. So again, go to getamazonmusic.com/thecomposerchronicles and start listening on Amazon Music Unlimited today. Besides being a devout Roman Catholic, Bruckner was a known supporter of the music of Richard Wagner. When he moved to Vienna to take on the post of professor of music theory at the Vienna Conservatory, his loyalty cost him a great deal. Vienna was home to a large presence of anti-Wagner factions, and Bruckner's public allegiance to Wagner's music made him a target. The symphony societies of the city would deem his music as unplayable, and at times they would try to sabotage performances of his works. When it came time to premiere his Symphony No. 3, no conductor would dare touch it, so he conducted it himself. This led to the orchestra members mocking him by playing as poorly as possible, adding in notes or taking out phrases, and even laughing at him to his face. Yet, he was one of the greatest organists in the city, and music enthusiasts would flock to hear him perform with no scrutiny. I would imagine that so much hatred towards him would take its toll emotionally. His string of bad luck continued when he was repeatedly rejected by a number of young women when he asked for their hand in marriage. He was also afflicted with a condition known as numeromania, which is a compulsion to count everything. Scholars believe that this numeromania may have had a larger impact on his music the older he got, so it makes sense that it took him longer and longer to compose as he aged. Musical phrases repeat themselves almost obsessively, and as an example, his 8th symphony could potentially take an hour and a half long if you repeat every phrase as intended. But there is one more obsession that Bruckner had that surely had an impact on his music. That obsession was with dead bodies. He obsessed so much over dead bodies that he would even stress out over his own, leaving detailed instructions on how to embalm his own corpse. In his teaching room, where all of his students could see, he kept a photograph of his mother on her deathbed on the wall, a photograph that he commissioned. His obsession with death and dead bodies seems fitting for a composer who would die while writing his last symphony, fixated on making sure that everything was perfect. One of Bruckner's students, Karl Hubi, would recount that he and Bruckner would attend the exhuming of Beethoven's body from its resting place in Wavering to be reburied at the Central Cemetery in 1888, not too long after Bruckner started his work on the Symphony No. 9. Out of curiosity, the exhumers decided to open the coffin, and of course, Bruckner was close enough to realize that this is what they were doing, and hastily walked over to get a closer look. As officials were measuring the body to properly prepare for the reburial, Bruckner pushed past them to get a closer look at the bones. Some accounts say that he was so mesmerized by the corpse that he stood there, staring at it, and not moving. Others claim that he cradled the skull in his arms like a newborn baby and kissed it before the officials forcefully removed it from his hands. In the commotion, the glass from his pince-nez had broken and presumably fell into the coffin. When Bruckner realized this on his way home, Ruby noted that Bruckner had not been upset that his pince-nez was broken. Rather, he was overjoyed that it would be reburied and remained with Beethoven forever. A similar catastrophe happened when the body of Schubert was also exhumed to be relocated in the Central Cemetery that same year. This time, Bruckner refused to let go of Schubert's skull. Any attempt to grab it from him was futile, and only when Bruckner decided to place it back into the coffin himself were they able to eject him from the gathering. Nobody really knows where this obsession came from. Musicologists believe that because of his deep roots in Roman Catholicism, he may have seen the bones of people he admired as relics. My opinion? Music and religion were Bruckner's world, at times being almost indistinguishable from one another. The musical masters, in their deaths, were now closer to God than he was at that moment, and their dead bodies, being attached to those musical masters, were another open door to the God he so deeply loved. This episode of the Composer Chronicles was written, researched, and edited by me, Stephen Schweigar, with theme music written by Daryl Banner. Sources and other music used in this episode can be found in the show notes. If you've enjoyed this episode, consider leaving a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or wherever you can leave a rating and review. And if you've really enjoyed this episode, become a member on Patreon. For as little as $1.50 per month, members get early access to ad-free versions of every episode, as well as a behind-the-scenes bonus podcast titled Unscripted. To become a member, sign up at patreon.com/thecomposerchronicles. Again, that's patreon.com/thecomposerchronicles, or click on the link in the show notes. Both ratings and memberships help the show to grow, so show your support by helping the podcast out. You can find the Composer Chronicles on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Cron Podcast. There you can stay up to date on all of the latest news. Next week, I am joined by my dear friend Andrew Shaw for the second installment of the Gameplay mini-series. In that episode, we are talking about the music from The Elder Scrolls Morrowind, Oblivion, and Skyrim, and how exactly they contribute to one's playing experience. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Alexandrian Media, art and culture for the modern era.